Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight under investigation. The Trump Organization's chief financial officer pleads guilty to tax fraud as other legal cases surround the former president. Then the invasion's impact. Grain shipments slowly increase out of Ukraine, potentially alleviating high global food prices. And help wanted. Despite an influx of federal funding, American cities and states can't find enough workers, leaving many essential jobs unfilled.
Well, you have to support your family. The rising costs of everything going on right now, and to be able to do the same job in the private sector, get paid X amount more, it's that decision at the end of the day.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. There is new trouble tonight for former President Trump's business empire. Alan Weisselberg, longtime chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, has pleaded guilty to 15 charges involving tax fraud. He said nothing after today's hearing in New York, but his plea deal requires him to testify at the Trump Organization's own trial in October. Weisselberg will be sentenced later. A federal magistrate in Florida says that he is inclined to release some of the affidavit behind the search of the Trump estate at Mar-a-Lago. Today, he gave the U.S. Justice Department a week to decide which sections it wants to keep secret. The search turned up classified White House material. We'll return to the Trump investigations after the news summary. In Ukraine, the UN called today for demilitarizing the area around Europe's largest nuclear plant. Kyiv and Moscow blame each other for shelling at the Zaporizhia plant. It's in an area now controlled by Russia. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres met today with President Zelensky in western Ukraine, but Russia has already refused to withdraw from the nuclear site.
Kyiv has repeatedly demonstrated its ability to stage provocations and its lack of ability to control nationalist formations. This is the same reason why the proposals to demilitarize the zone around Zaporizhia nuclear plant are unacceptable.
The Russians did not say if they would allow international inspectors into the plant. Today's talks in Ukraine also included the president of Turkey and focused on grain shipments stalled due to the war. We'll return to that story later in the program. The death toll in Afghanistan has reached at least 21 after a mosque in Kabul was bombed last night. Taliban security forces cordoned off the Blue Dome Mosque today. The explosion killed a prominent cleric, among others, and wounded dozens more. There's been no claim of responsibility. Back in this country, the man accused of stabbing Salman Rushdie was denied bail in western New York State today. Hadi Matar appeared in court after a grand jury indicted him. He pleaded not guilty to attacking the author at a literary event this month. Rushdie remains hospitalized in Pennsylvania. Cleveland Browns quarterback Deshaun Watson has agreed to an 11-game suspension and a $5 million fine for alleged sexual misconduct. The NFL announced it today. Two dozen women had accused Watson of sexual assault and harassment when he played for the Houston Texans. Two grand juries declined to indict him, and he insisted today he's innocent.
Just because, you know, settlements and things like that happen doesn't mean that a person is guilty for anything. I feel like a person has the opportunity to stand on his innocence and prove that, and we prove that on the legal side, and we're just going to continue to push forward as an individual and as a person.
Watson recently settled 23 of 24 lawsuits involving the allegations against him. U.S. health officials announced today that they are setting aside another 50,000 doses of monkeypox vaccine for gay pride events. There have been more than 13,000 cases reported in the U.S. so far, nearly all of them involving sex between men. The extra vaccine will go to at least a dozen events scheduled in the next 2 months. On Wall Street, stocks managed small gains in choppy trading today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 18 points to close just below 34,000. The NASDAQ rose 27 points. The S&P 500 added 9. And former First Lady Rosalynn Carter celebrated her 95th birthday today. She has now lived longer than any other First Lady except Bess Truman, who lived to be 97. Mrs. Carter's husband, Jimmy, is the oldest living former president. He will turn 98 on October 1st. Happy birthday, Mrs. Carter. Still to come on the NewsHour, Vermont prepares to elect its first female representative to Congress. Democracy advocates raise the alarm about election deniers in charge of vote counts. Singer Bonnie Raitt discusses her new album and dynamic career, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we reported, former Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg pleaded guilty today to tax fraud. And as part of the plea deal, he is expected to testify against the company later this year. To discuss what this means for the former president, I'm joined by Andrea Bernstein, who covers Trump's legal issues for NPR. Andrea Bernstein, welcome back to the NewsHour. So we know the former president himself is not charged here, but how unusual is it for the company of a former president to be involved in criminal charges like this?
Well, I think this is the only time it's ever happened. There has never been a post-presidency like Trump's. And I think what was so extraordinary about the plea deal today is here you had a man who was sort of the closest thing you could come to as a physical embodiment of Trump's business, saying, yes, Your Honor, I committed these crimes 15 times.
And what exactly, remind us, what exactly is he pleading, did he plead guilty to?
So just a little over a year ago, the Manhattan District Attorney charged Mr. Weisselberg with 15 felonies. Basically, the scheme was, which lasted over 15 years, was for him to lie about his income, to say it was much lower than it actually was by taking his income in things like a luxury apartment, Mercedes Benzes for him and his wife, and private school tuition for his children, thereby avoiding taxes on millions of dollars. And what he pleaded guilty to was everything from scheme to defraud, a scheme that lasted, he admitted today, from 2005 to 2021, during the entire time when his boss, Donald Trump, was president. And of course, Donald Trump never divested from his business, so he was still at the top of the corporate structure at the time that these crimes were committed.
So as we said, former President Trump is not named here, but this took place, as you just said, over 16 years. Is it conceivable that the former president didn't know what was going on?
Well, the district attorney, the Manhattan district attorney, was preparing an indictment against Mr. Trump himself. That never went forward for a variety of reasons, mostly having to do with a changeover in district attorneys. Everybody that I know that has ever worked for Trump, and we saw this in the January 6th hearings, everybody that seems to work for him makes it clear that he has a very sharp eye on what is going on around him. That said, he was not charged. His company has pleaded not guilty, and there's been no evidence introduced of his personal knowledge, except that we did hear today in one of the counts that Donald Trump paid some of the benefits, the private school tuition, from his own personal account, and also kept a record of some of these payments. As to whether he knew it was illegal, that's a question that remains unanswered at this point.
So he signed his name to some of the checks, but it's not clear that he knew what was going on. Is that it?
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, let's not lose the significance that his business, the business named Trump, is charged with a crime. And that, as we said, has never happened before in the history of the United States, and also very serious crimes. And under New York law, when a top executive says, I committed a crime, it's a very short road from there to convicting the company. Now, the company hasn't pleaded guilty. The company is, in fact, slated to go to trial in October. But now, with the guaranteed testimony of Mr. Weisselberg, who is going to say, I did these things, I defrauded the taxpayers of the money that they deserve to get so I could personally benefit, there is no clear way, prosecutors have told me, that the company can get out of that.
And is it, can you give us a sense, do we know what kinds of questions Alan Weisselberg is going to be asked this fall at the trial?
Right. So there's no indication that he's going to say Donald Trump knew any of these things I did. But what he has promised to do under penalty of getting a much more severe sentence is to answer questions truthfully. So this will be a chance for the jury and the public to get all sorts of detailed questions about how this scheme worked, how it was played out across the company, which other executives were involved. This is a very embarrassing, detailed look at a president who was so secretive. He went to the U.S. Supreme Court twice to keep his business records out of the hands of the Manhattan District Attorney. So we expect to learn much more about his company if, as expected, this case goes to trial. And that could be very embarrassing, particularly since Mr. Trump is, as we know, considering another run for president.
And just finally, Andrea Bernstein, while all this is going on in New York, down in Florida, having to do with the FBI search of the former president's estate at Mar-a-Lago, a judge ruled today that the Justice Department needs to go back and redact any language it doesn't want made public in the affidavit that ended up being used seeking that search warrant. How does that play into any other legal worries the former president has?
Well, it does seem like it's a very big worry when you have the U.S. Justice Department investigating you, as we now know, under the Espionage Act and other potential crimes. But it looks like we may learn more. Now, this has many steps to go through. Obviously, the judge has asked the Justice Department to come back. It can be appealed. It doesn't seem like we will see anything tomorrow. But we see a pattern here, which is the president hiding things, the president not revealing things, and a president being investigated from everything to whether his company being investigated from everything to whether he wrote a check for his CFO's grandchildren's tuition to whether he mishandled classified documents. That is quite a roster for a former president.
Journalist Andrea Bernstein, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
With most of the nation's primary elections behind us now, we're starting to get a clearer look at the shape of November's races. And now the only state that has never sent a woman to Congress is poised to elect its first. But as congressional correspondent Lisa Desjardins explains, that expected milestone comes as women still struggle to be elected in equal numbers as men.
To date, 399 women have walked the halls of power in Congress as representatives and senators, and they have come from 49 states.
And now, please join me in welcoming my wife, Becca Ballant!
Becca Ballant is poised to make Vermont the 50th state, the last to send its first woman to Congress after she won the Democratic primary in the deep blue Green Mountain state this month.
Hello, Brattleboro.
It's sinking in little by little. It's very exciting, and it's also a little daunting, as you can imagine. Being the first of anything is a challenge because you want to do right by everybody. You want to make sure you represent the state well.
Women wield substantial power in Vermont, one of the first states to elect a female governor. Three of the last four speakers of the House have been women, and Ballant is president of the state Senate. But even among supporters, questions sometimes went past her qualifications and to fear of prejudice.
There was this sense of maybe Vermont first isn't ready for a woman in this role, and second isn't ready for a gay woman.
Tonight, together, we all made history, all of us.
So what's taken Vermont so long to elect a congresswoman? Michelle Swerz teaches about women and politics at Georgetown, writing two books and a textbook on the subject. She says in Vermont and elsewhere, it's a question of opportunity.
Some of what you see going on is that it's just harder for women as non-incumbents running as challengers and as in open seat races to get elected.
Vermont is a small state with a small delegation in Congress. Seats rarely open, and incumbents have won every time they've run since 1990.
I'm proud to be Vermont's longest-serving senator.
The state's lone House seat indirectly opened up after Senator Patrick Leahy announced his retirement after nearly 50 years.
When you're waiting for somebody to retire for that long, it's a pretty long wait to get into Congress.
Women account for slightly more than 50% of the U.S. population, but are not even 30% of the U.S. House, and even less, about a quarter of the U.S. Senate.
Why? Swerz says there are several factors.
Well, there is a lot of research that shows that women need to be asked more, that they're more reluctant to throw their hat in the ring.
There are fewer of them in state and local offices, which feed congressional primaries. And big donors are less likely to write them big checks.
For many people, if they see a woman's name on the ballot, that person would have to clear a much higher bar than someone with a traditionally male name.
Charles Robbins runs Stony Brook University's Center for Changing Systems of Power. He says gender bias can be subconscious and leached down from one generation to the next, making it difficult for many men and women to picture a woman in charge.
The patriarchy and the male-dominated system, it has influenced every part of our culture, every part of our society, and no place is that truer than in government and in politics.
There's an additional gender divide between the country's two biggest parties. In the House, just 16% of Republicans are women, but the figure is 41% for House Democrats. Jennifer Carroll, a Republican and former lieutenant governor of Florida, wants to see conservatives catch up.
The party itself has not put a concerted effort in to say we are going to go out and recruit viable females to run for office. But the Democrats have.
Carroll's a national spokesperson for Maggie's List, a political action committee that works to recruit and elect conservative women.
And Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order under.
She says a lack of vocabulary within the GOP doesn't help her cause.
Female candidates have a challenge in that you cannot come out and say, well, elect me because I'm a female. The guys can come out and say, elect me because I'm a strong guy and I'm going to go fight for you.
In 2020, Republican women had their best showing ever in the House and now have more than doubled their previous number from 15 to 35.
We saw that we needed to get our conservative female candidates over the finish line in the primaries to compete in a general election. If you don't win the primary, you're not even going to make it to the general election.
This 100 years after Montana elected the country's first woman to Congress, Jeanette Rankin. The state has yet to send its second woman to Washington, as Vermont is poised for its first.
I hope I'm making it easier for the next person to come up. That's what I hope.
Meanwhile, women's gains in Congress and state legislatures aren't matched at the highest rungs.
When it comes to governors, people seem to trust women more as legislators. Legislature is a more of a consensus building type of position, and executive leadership is harder.
19 states still haven't elected a woman as governor. Nancy Pelosi remains the only woman elected to lead either chamber of Congress. And while Kamala Harris is second in command, the country is still waiting on its first female commander-in-chief. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lisa Desjardins.
This midterm election cycle, candidates are vying for state offices that are responsible for running and certifying elections. Several among these candidates continue to deny the results of the 2020 election. Amna Nawaz has more on what's at stake.
That's right, Judy. Election deniers are winning Republican primary races in critical battleground states. Their victories have raised the stakes for the November midterms, as the power to oversee elections could be granted to the same people who falsely claim the last one was fraudulent. Following all of this closely is Amy Gardner of The Washington Post, who joins me here. Amy, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
So you did a deep dive into a number of things. One I want to ask you about first is looking specifically at six states that were key to the 2020 election. Those states were Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And you looked specifically at the Republican nominees for certain offices, people who repeated that 2020 election lie, people you call election deniers, right? Which offices did you zero in on and why? And how prevalent was that lie among those Republican nominees?
We wanted to look at the offices that have say-so over election administration and election certification. And so we looked at statewide offices that have those powers. It's governors in every state who certify the electors. It's secretaries of state in many states, and also lieutenant governors and attorneys general in some states have powers that are important to the election process, and federal office, Congress. So that's what we looked at. And the significance of those six states is that those are the six states that Donald Trump contested in 2020, and they're also the six states that decided the 2020 outcome for Biden. Biden won all six of those states. And if you look at the results of our survey of these offices, you can see in just three of those six states, Arizona, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, election deniers won who say that they would not have certified the result in 2020. And so those three states add up to enough electoral votes, or did in 2020, to have denied Joe Biden 270 votes. So that just tells you what's at stake here if these folks win their general elections in November and we have a contested election in 2024.
Well, I think you said overall in those six states, it was the overwhelming majority of those Republican nominees, right, had repeated that lie to some degree. But you mentioned some of these folks, and one of them will mention, for example, like the Arizona Republican gubernatorial candidate there, Carrie Lake, who has said, look, if I were in office in 2020, I would not have certified the results, despite the fact that Joe Biden won Arizona.
She's actually said that those who did certify the result in Arizona should be in prison.
And so what do experts you talk to say about this? I mean, assuming if she wins, if the same things were to happen in 2024, what do experts say about guardrails? What prevents someone like Carrie Lake from basically disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of voters?
We don't know. What constitutional scholars and election lawyers told me as I worked on this story is that, you know, certainly Democrats and voting rights expert or advocacy groups would sue immediately if someone like Carrie Lake declined to certify a popular result in her state. Mm-hmm. But would every judge in this country uphold that norm? Norms are only norms until they're broken. And a lot of these experts I spoke to say they're really, really alarmed at the prospect of certainly fewer guardrails being in place in 2024 than were in 2020. And look at the chaos that we had then.
Well, and when you look at what people are supporting, I mean, these candidates are repeating the lie because people believe in it. Millions of Republican voters do believe in it. Another part of your analysis I want to point out, when you looked at the fact that people who repeat this lie are winning, you looked across 41 states and found that out of 469 nominating contests so far, more than half of all Republican winners, 250 candidates, have repeated that election lie, or election deniers, as you say. So there's an expectation built that they will fight, even if the next election, say 2024, is definitive. Is there an expectation they're going to fight, challenge, block because the constituency expects them to now?
I think that the answer is yes. I think that denying the 2020 election has become a price of admission in the Republican Party. It's gone beyond just fealty to Trump. It's fealty to the false statements about that election. And that's definitely what's coming in this country.
We should also say this is not just a hypothetical, looking ahead to 2024, right? Already, as you've cited in your reporting, a number of states, 19 so far, have passed voting laws. Critics say restrict voting, justified in part by the election law. So when you talk to Republican lawmakers, what do they tell you about why they've been pushing some of those votes?
It depends on who I talk to, but it's kind of interesting. I've talked to a number of lawmakers in Georgia, for instance, in Texas, for instance, both of which passed such restrictive laws last year, who say, not for attribution, but who admit, you know, off the record, they had to. They had to throw this bone to their constituents who believed that the elections had been stolen, and they had to do something to show that they were pro-election integrity. So it's an admission that they are, it's a solution in search of a problem, really.
What does this tell you about the potency of denying elections in the Republican Party right now?
I mean, it's everywhere. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, announced the prosecution of 20 people who allegedly voted fraudulently in that state. And it was a huge televised press conference. He's coming to Pennsylvania tomorrow to campaign with Doug Mastriano, one of the other big election deniers that I found in my survey, the gubernatorial nominee in Pennsylvania. So going to Pennsylvania is a great clue that Ron DeSantis is running for president, which we've all been speculating about already. But so the day before he goes on a presidential jag, he's making a big announcement about election fraud. I mean, that tells you everything right there.
Fair to say 20 votes would not change an election one way or the other. Amy Gardner, the reporting is so important. We'll be following your work.
Thank you.
From the Washington Post. Thank you.
In western Ukraine today, President Volodymyr Zelensky hosted Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, both architects of a deal last month that allows Ukraine to export food amid the war and a global food shortage. But has that UN broker deal been effective in achieving its goals thus far? Nick Schifrin has the story.
The UN called it a beacon of hope, one of the world's breadbaskets once again able to export. For 3 weeks, ships carrying Ukrainian grain, sunflower, soya, and wheat have left Ukrainian ports through a Russian blockade. Today, three of the guarantors of that deal met in Ukraine's west to assess how far they'd come and how far they still had to go.
There is a global need for more ships that can export Ukrainian produce in a secure way. Our country will be a guarantor for global food security.
For years, Ukraine helped provide that guarantee. With Russia, it exported one quarter of the world's wheat. But the war, combined with a historic drought in the Horn of Africa and complications from COVID, have created a global food crisis. The UN broker deal is designed to allow Ukraine to export 22 million tons of grain. The first Africa-bound ship left yesterday. The Brave Commander carries World Food Program purchased cargo destined for Ethiopia. 23,000 metric tons of wheat will go to a nation with 20 million people facing hunger. But so far, most exports are not going to those with the most need. Of 25 ships, more than a quarter have gone to Turkey. Iran and South Korea each receive five. Next on the list, China, Ireland, and Italy. And the exports so far are a fraction of what's needed. 700,000 tons of food have left Ukrainian shores. 20 million tons remain trapped in Ukrainian silos.
Let's have no illusions. There is a long way to go before this will be translated into the daily life of people at their local bakery and in their markets. Supply chains are still disrupted, and energy and transportation costs remain unacceptably high.
And some of the exports aren't arriving at their intended destinations. The very first ship that left Ukraine arrived not in its original reported destination, Lebanon, but in Russia ally Syria. Syria also received stolen Ukrainian grain on a Russian ship that arrived just today.
And for more on food exports from Ukraine, we turn to Joe Glauber, senior research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. He previously served as the chief economist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Thank you very much. Welcome to the NewsHour. How much of an impact right now is this deal having?
It's small, but it's hopefully will get bigger. Right now, you know, roughly 700,000 tons have moved. That's about a tenth of what Ukraine does on a monthly basis during their peak season. And this is their peak season as we come into wheat harvest, and they want to be shipping that out to the rest of the world.
700,000, just to put that in perspective, you know, the goal is for 20 million tons to be exported.
Yeah.
Is that even realistic?
Well, I think they have serious storage problems. Remember, they have a crop from last year that's been trapped inside of Ukraine. They're in the process of harvesting a wheat crop. And in the fall, they're going to have a corn crop and barley crop and other crops that are going to come in. What that's put stress on is the storage capacity they have. Even with this potential of exporting a little bit more out of those Black Sea ports.
One of the good signs that we've seen so far, according to the Secretary General today, is that prices have come down for the rest of the world. The FAO says its food price index fell by 9% in July, the largest decline since 2008. So is that a sign that this deal, at least initially, is having some positive impact?
Well, it's a whole bunch of factors, actually. One is Russia has exported a lot more than I think was initially thought. We have a good crop coming out of Canada. But again, no question, the fact that we're actually able to get grain out of Ukraine through those Black Sea ports is a very positive for world food prices.
As we pointed out, these ships have gone to Turkey, South Korea, even Ireland and Italy, only one to the Horn of Africa, at least so far. Why?
Well, a lot of the grain that's left Ukraine in the last couple of weeks through this corridor were ships that were docked in the Ukraine ports before the war, and so they were targeted for those buyers. And though that included, yes, a lot of corn going to Europe, it included a little bit going to the Middle East, and then some wheat going to the Horn of Africa. And so the shift will change as we see more wheat coming out of Ukraine.
The Joint Coordination Center, the UN-run body that's coordinating this in Istanbul, said to me today that while there have been 25 ships that left Ukraine, 20 are arriving in Ukraine now. Is that a sign of what you were just suggesting, that this food is now going to be going to more places?
Yeah, I think we will see a mix of buyers. Remember that if you look at who the markets that Ukraine would typically ship to, it's a lot in North Africa, it's a lot in the Middle East as far as wheat's concerned. For corn, and they ship a lot of corn around the world, a lot of that goes to China, a lot of that goes to Europe. Now, some of that goes to the World Food Program and others that, you know, help alleviate hunger and other important things like that.
Beyond this deal, do you believe that there's enough being done to ease a global food crisis?
Well, the real issue, I think, long run for Ukraine is ending the war and bringing back their agricultural system to some sort of normalcy. I think with Ukraine hampered by a war going on and the fact that they aren't shipping as much as they could ship normally, that means lower prices for producers, that means less production. And because of the important role Ukraine plays in world markets, I think that means continued tight supplies. Because overall global stock levels continue to be fairly low, that means any sort of disruption in terms of droughts or other things could really cause price spikes. So that's the real concern longer run as we move forward over the next year or so.
And how important is it to solve some of these problems given how acute this global food crisis is?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it is extremely important to at least get this corridor up and running, at least make sure that we can get exports back to some sort of level that's closer to what they normally would be shipping. But obviously the real goal is to get an end to the war.
Joe Glauber, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The number of Americans filing for unemployment benefits fell to 250,000 last week, a sign that demand for workers remains high. But that strong overall labor market has made it difficult for state and local governments to find enough workers, affecting almost every service they provide, from trash pickup to policing. Special correspondent and Washington Post columnist Catherine Rampell has the story.
I'm afraid to ask, what's floating on top?
So grease is one of our biggest problems.
It's grease. On the most glamorous of NewsHour reporting trips, Bill Davis showed us around his workplace, a wastewater treatment plant. That's exactly what you think it is.
Wastewater is typically a light brown color, and it sort of smells earthy. I mean, it's not real in your face.
You've had some time to acclimate yourself to it, though.
Oh, is that what it is? It's just poopy water.
Public service is noble work, but it's not for everyone. It can be smelly, stressful, and often not super lucrative. Here in Richland County, South Carolina, nearly a quarter of government jobs are now vacant, up from 13% before the pandemic. And it's not the only place struggling to hire, says researcher Joshua Franzel.
Overall, state and local employment is still below its peak from the February of 2020 time period.
Nationwide, private sector jobs have recovered, with more jobs today than pre-COVID. But state and local governments are still way behind, despite a lot of COVID relief money from the feds. Partly, this is about retirements.
The state and local sector has been 3 to 5 years older on average relative to their private sector peers.
And those not yet retirement age are demanding a lot more pay. But government employers are often slow to adjust.
One of the things we were challenged with is if you've got $15 an hour and you're going to go to Amazon and make $18 an hour to drive a forklift and pick up boxes and listen to your AirPods all day, do you want to do that, or do you want to come play in the poopy water, or do you want to go make 20%, 25% more and work at Amazon?
It's especially hard for governments to match pay for jobs where private employers are rapidly raising wages, like truck driving and construction.
What would help the situation?
Money.
Brian Knight and Will Truesdale of Jefferson County, Colorado's Road and Bridge Department said they were short 36 out of 190 positions.
When people are leaving, what do they tell you about why they're leaving?
The majority that we hear is pay. You know, you have to support your family. The rising costs of fuel, food, everything going on right now. And to be able to do the same job in the private sector, get paid X amount more, it's that decision at the end of the day.
Worker shortages alongside higher material costs are causing problems all year round. In the summer, potholes aren't getting filled. In the winter, roads aren't being plowed.
If you don't have the personnel to do it, we can't complete these projects. We can't do what we do.
So our road network, it's deteriorating quicker than ever. We have more cars on the road, more people in the area. With the staffing, we're just falling farther behind. The amount of lane miles we should be maintaining a road or improving is dropping.
Constituents notice, Jefferson County Manager Don Davis says.
The citizens, all they know is they pay taxes and they expect these services to be done. They don't necessarily understand that it's unlimited expectations against limited resources.
In Richland County, sometimes that means garbage pickup problems, says Public Works Director Mike Maloney.
We have had some other issues with miscollections and that, and those were due to lack of workforce, replacement workforce that wasn't trained properly, and also the equipment.
Trucks and other equipment have hit supply chain snags, but contractor Charles Bruce Johnson's key concern is still labor.
There's been a very low pool of drivers that have been interested, and it's been a challenge.
Jefferson County Sheriff Jeff Schrader says it's not only about the money. Some jobs have become less attractive for other reasons.
Through 2020, we saw a lot of people who were just getting out of law enforcement. People who are getting hired into law enforcement aren't my age. They're younger people. Their social groups were probably questioning, based upon the dialogue that was going on, the role of police and its legitimacy.
The work has always been stressful and polarizing, but today it's even harder to recruit applicants.
From 2019, pre-pandemic, pre-George Floyd, up until 2021, we saw a 39% decrease in the number of applications for deputy sheriffs.
He argues the stakes are high.
If public safety, sheriff's offices, police departments aren't able to have staff that put first responders out on the street, or we're not able to bring people into jail that need to be in jail because of staffing concerns, ultimately, the public's at risk.
Between higher crime, the pandemic, and dangerous heat waves, first responders are spread thin, says Richland's Assistant County Administrator, John Thompson.
We see that because of the increased demand for services, that means an increased workload for that particular crew, for that paramedic and for that EMT working on that ambulance.
Captain Winta Adams with the Emergency Services Department says burnout is worsening worker shortages.
As soon as the crew goes in service, they're normally getting a 911 call, you know, right off the bat. And they'll run the call, get to the hospital, get another 911 call. run that call, get to the hospital, get another 911 call. It is very hard for them to find time to take a break, whether that's to eat breakfast or lunch or just be able to use the facilities.
They're recruiting aggressively to find more staff and recently opened a new training boot camp.
Our job as EMS professionals is to save lives. If we don't have the adequate staff to run the calls to get to the patients that need life-saving measures, then we are not able to do our job saving lives.
Government managers are also trying to increase pay, though voters and elected officials are not always keen on handing more tax dollars to public workers.
There's a 4% cost of living adjustment that will go into effect for the next fiscal year.
Even though the inflation has
been higher
than 4%.
Yeah, absolutely. And I tell you, we can't compete with inflation.
Governments are also recruiting by singing the virtues of public service. You know?
Government has got a bad rap, and local government gets broad brushed into that national narrative.
But, says Jefferson County's Davis,
you know, I was in the Marine Corps for 27 years, and people that work at local government, I have found them to be every bit as patriotic as any Marine, sailor, soldier, airman, or coastie that I ever led in almost 30 years. They really want to make a difference.
That only goes so far.
The challenge is that when you're asking employees to give more, but they still have bills to pay. That makes it really difficult in the long run when you don't have the revenue or you don't have the money to be able to pay them what is competitive in the market.
As it turns out, even Davis himself has now been poached by another local government. He switched jobs shortly after this interview. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Catherine Rampell in Jefferson County, Colorado.
And we'll be back shortly with an interview with singer Bonnie Raitt. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps to keep programs like ours on the air. For those stations staying with us, while some employers are struggling to find workers, Americans who have retired from the labor force are concerned about another problem, housing costs. So we take another look with Paul Solman, who met up with some baby boomers who've taken on roommates as a way to ease their financial burden.
I'm going to get some sunflower seeds. There.
For years, Becky Miller, age 72, had only one companion.
There you go.
Maxie, a green-cheeked conure.
That's Mommy's Maxie bird.
But Maxie doesn't pay rent. And Miller, a retired receptionist, was having trouble making ends meet.
I'm single, so I wasn't able to put a lot into my IRA. So I depleted it. My mortgage and my HOA fees were over half of my income. So I decided for financial reasons to get a roommate.
64-year-old divorcee Marlene Mears moved into Miller's Longmont, Colorado home a year and a half ago.
I like saving money. I like having another person to talk to have a relationship with. It's nice to have some companionship when you're at home.
It's not happy.
Miller and Mears found each other on Silvernest, an internet platform that matches older homeowners with housemates.
There's a significant portion of the population going into their mid-60s, you know, with $20,000, $30,000 in their 401ks or nothing saved.
So seniors like Miller and Mears feel the need to home share, says Silvernest president Riley Gibson.
Since the start of 2022, with inflation rising, just people under so much more financial pressure, the first half of this year we've seen by far more activity, probably 2 to 3 times the activity we've seen in previous years.
But it's just part of a much longer term trend, explains Harvard's Jennifer Malinsky.
We often hear about the Golden Girls television show.
I know it's awful, but I have this incredible sweet tooth.
What is it?
Cheesecake.
What kind?
Chocolate.
Oh, I think this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Turns out Dorothy, Rose, Blanche, and Sophia were a harbinger.
20 years ago, it was about 1% of older adults were house sharing with a non-relative. Today, it's over a million older adults, more than double the number in that time. What people do is they start cutting back on other necessities like food and out-of-pocket medical care, insurance, which really affects much more than your financial well-being. It affects your overall well-being.
Brenda Atchison's house in the Roxbury neighborhood of Boston has been in her family since 1946. But after a career in IT and education ended, Atchison struggled to maintain the place.
I kind of retired prematurely and realized I had a big old house that needed be heated, needed repairs, etc., and that I was older, so I knew I was moving into an area where I was going to have a fixed income and begin to say, oh, how are we going to work this out?
She worked it out by renting a room to a young grad student. So surprisingly lovely, in fact, the student living upstairs now.
Hi, Kristen. Hi.
Is roommate number six.
Hello. So, my bed's. And then I spend most of my time sitting here.
Rwandan Dr. Christian Mazimpaka is studying public health at Boston University.
She's very organized, and she likes the place to be clean. And that was not new to me because my mom was like that.
Does she remind you of your mom?
Yeah. So when I forget to take the trash out.
She'll remind you?
Yeah, she...
I see. And Atchison, who's single, now really likes having someone around.
To be able to be connecting with people who are outside of my sphere. Christian is not my peer.
Connection is key, since social isolation for the elderly is linked to higher risk of depression, dementia, premature death. At first, Becky Miller wasn't so sure she wanted someone sharing her Colorado space either.
I thought, oh my gosh, somebody's going to come in and use my kitchen.
I did.
And she did.
But that turned into the proverbial blessing in disguise.
I don't have to cook supper every night.
I think I'll let him.
But of course, taking in an unknown roommate isn't for everyone.
I don't want strangers in my house.
That's my cousin Deborah Sines. Every week I Zoom with her and other relatives, all retired single women.
I don't care how nice they are. I don't want them messing with my stuff. I just love being able to eat if I want to, not eat if I don't want to, not having to put clothes on if I don't want to, and just feeling, I think the word is free.
Does this resonate for you, Rosemary?
Yes, yes. I would rather cut down on other things than have a paying roommate.
By contrast, my sister, Ronnie, a widow, started renting out her spare room. How much of the motivation was financial?
I'd say most of it was financial. But I found it was rewarding to have another human on the property also. Sense of company, I think.
Plant to your left palm.
As more boomers retire, and if the cost of living keeps climbing, home sharing may become a commonplace, says Silver Nest's Riley Gibson.
We're going to have to get creative and try some new things, find some new ways of living, finding new ways to think about the single family home, because we have to.
Brenda Atchison is glad she did.
Being housing insecure, that's not comfortable. It's not, I can tell you, it's not a comfortable feeling. I lived on that edge for quite some time, so I don't ever want to go back to that.
But she says,
it's the social piece that means more to me now than the financial piece ever could.
Becky Miller, she agrees.
I get a feeling of peace. I have always been by myself, and I've discovered that I have room in my heart for another person.
Relationships born of necessity that have grown into something a lot less transactional. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Bonnie Raitt is touring the country after releasing her 21st album, Just Like That, earlier this year. Jeff Bennett sat down with her when she was in town for our weekend news program to discuss her dynamic career and what she's learned about herself along the way.
Well, let's talk about this new album. It's doing incredibly well. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Most of the album are covers. How do you do that creatively? How do you take somebody else's songwriting, their arrangement, and then put your own spin on it?
You know, it's just something I've always done. I mean, I grew up loving Aretha Franklin and Ray Charles and Frank Sinatra and my dad, and they always put their own spin on the songs that they picked. And I love taking an older song like Del Shannon's Runaway in 1977. I did kind of an Al Green thing on it. Mm-hmm. And then I did a Jerry Rafferty hit and turned it into a reggae song. And then I did an NXS song and a Talking Heads song over the years. So it's really fun for me to, a lot of times they're either by guys and then I put them in my key and I put some slide on it and it's absolutely different.
I want to talk about one of the songs that you wrote called Down the Hall.
I asked the nurse where he was going. She said, hospice down the hall.
It was inspired by a true story of a prisoner who was at a prisoner hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's told through his point of view. What drew you to that story that first appeared, I guess, in the New York Times?
Yeah, I read it in the New York Times Magazine, and I saw this photo essay with it and the article interviewing these guys that for no benefit, they don't get their sentence shortened and they don't make money. They just, you know, been in there for whatever they felt about what they did in their previous life, why they were there. I put myself in the place of a guy that was just had compassion for the guys that at the end of their life don't have anybody to hang out with them at the last moments. And the fact that there's these 75 programs I found out all over the country where prisoners can volunteer and get trained to help care and, you know, be their pal and be there at the end. And I was so incredibly moved. I thought it would make a great story.
And Living for the Ones, that I gather was a song about personal loss that you've experienced.
Yeah.
When I first heard it, I thought, oh, this is about the pandemic.
Yeah, well, it kind of is, okay. Yeah. It's about everybody we lost.
Yeah, I'm living for the ones who didn't make it. Cut down through the fault of their own. Just keep them in mind. Every chance is denied. And you ever start to bitch and moan.
What I started doing when my brother passed from brain cancer in 2009 was I'm living every day for the life he didn't get to have. Mm. And that is literally in the lyrics of Living for the Ones. It's how do you get through? I'm living for the ones who didn't make it. You know, I'm just gonna face the sun and look out the window and take a walk and take a deep breath, and that's the life they didn't get to have.
So many of your songs, especially on this latest album, focus on grace and redemption. How has that manifested in your life, that's something that you're focusing on in your music?
Well, it's hard to say why those stories move me. I mean, I hear in 35 years of recovery, I've heard some incredible stories in the meetings of people who just lost everything and never thought they could reconcile with their family or their parents or get a job or their health. And people find a way to reach out to each other and bring that redemption and grace and forgiveness. And that's a story that is universal and timeless.
Yeah.
But especially, I had no idea the pandemic was going to happen when I wrote the songs, but it's really resonating for me and the audience. I think that's why the album is striking a chord.
Don't patronize me.
You're at a really interesting point in your career in that you've been getting all of these accolades, Lifetime Achievement Awards, and yet you're still very much in your prime. What does
Thank
that feel
you.
Like, on the one hand, to be so prolific and to still be producing music, and on the other hand, being heralded as the legend that you are?
Well, it was a big surprise to be getting these awards now. But I'm so grateful that people feel that way about me. I was joking. I said, what do you guys know? Am I sick and I don't know it? I mean, are you? But I just think that, there's not that many people that last 50 years in the business. And because of my activism and my role model as a band leader and a lead guitar player, and, you know, I do a lot of different kinds of music, and I think it's wonderful to be recognized for who I am in the world, not just the way that I sing. But I was surprised and pleasantly surprised, as I am with the reception to this record. I just was putting out another record, and I didn't expect it to get all this attention, but it feels really, on top of coming back from the pandemic, it feels fantastic. Yeah.
And she deserves all that attention. Thank you, Jeff Bennett, and thank you, Bonnie Raitt. And you can watch an extended version of Jeff's interview with her on our website, pbs.org/newshour. Also online right now, New Orleans is renewing its search for the remains of four victims who were attacked at the popular gay bar Upstairs Lounge nearly 50 years ago. We explore why the effort has taken this long, and we talk with a family who's been pushing for answers. You can read more on our website. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.